That's right. I was planning for us to work up to this last time, but we kind of stopped. And so we want to think about, I was going to try to, I didn't have enough time to piece together like all popular songs that like had this in the title or key choruses or points. So, and I won't sing them for you at this point, but they're out there. I think it's important that Christians especially have a, when we talk about sex and when we talk about sex within marriage, I think it's important that we have a good understanding of what we're talking about, because I think for Christians and even for the broader culture, it almost becomes this kind of mystical thing, especially in a Christian culture that values waiting until marriage for sex, where it's kind of like, well, you know, you save it, and then when you do have it, it's amazing and it's magical. And even some of the stuff in West can tend toward kind of like, you know, sometimes I think painting not necessarily a completely realistic picture of sex within marriage. And so I think this is important to talk about. I'll probably at certain points, you know, we were talking about this around the lunch table in the faculty room upstairs yesterday. Yes, it's true. Everybody's like, what? Yeah, so we were thinking about this, and you know, one of the analogies, this is the analogy that Dr. Fisher came up with. He said, you know, it's a lot like you have in your head the image of Disneyland and then actual Disneyland. It's like image of Disneyland, magical kingdom, all your dreams come true. You get there and it's just hot and you're waiting in line. So that was his. That was his. Yeah. Right. He wanted to be sure that I properly cited him as the source for that. So you can put down that quote. It was interesting because Professor Hogeboom is in relating. She's just completing a master's level or a doctorate level course in counseling. And she was saying how, as they've talked about, especially doing marital counseling, one of the things that her professor, her instructor said, you know, anytime he has couples who come in for counseling, he said, you know, you need to write in large letters on the board, sex takes work. Right? That it is, again, this is where the movies probably don't help us. Where it's this kind of mystical, like it's this thing that happens, and then when it is portrayed in movies, it's just, it's amazing, and it's you know, there's nice music playing, and it's so wonderful, but instead it takes work. And so these, I think, are my attempt to try to capture some key points that I think we need to acknowledge about sex within marriage. That it does take time, attentiveness, and work. So it's not something, this is where the idea of soulmates again maybe comes into this, that you know, I meet a soulmate and then everything is magical, including our physical intimacy. It takes time, attentiveness, and work to understand your spouse, your partner, yourself. It takes time, right? Like most things in life, usually the first time you try something, you're not that good at it. It's like, what? So this is true. And it's interesting. I remember even talking about this with other folks who, you know, I went to a Christian college down the road. And so for most couples there, the intention was to save sex for marriage. That's good. But then when they talk about their experience of what that looks like, especially over, you know, the first few months, the first year, the first couple years, it takes time, attentiveness, and work. And people thought, what? You know, we tried, but we didn't actually have vaginal intercourse on our wedding night. Right? People are like, what? What did he just say? Right? So this is, but even that it takes time and attentiveness and work to do this. It's also something that typically, most surveys show, not to gross everybody out, surveys show that, again, over time, it gets better. That usually people, especially in their 40s and 50s, report the greatest amount of satisfaction. Everyone's like, how old am I? what does this mean? Right? But that's the way it is. So it takes time and attentiveness and work. And so, you know, this is where, in some sense, I think we don't want to set the bar too low, but I think the danger oftentimes is we set the bar too high. We expect that it's going to be this amazing thing. And what you find out, especially in counseling and interacting pastorally with different people, that this is an area of struggle for a lot of people. It's not easy. It's not magical. It doesn't feel sacred or like prayer. It can be a real struggle and a real obstacle in many marriages. Also important to remember, sex is always more than sex. That when we are talking about interacting with people, with persons, that the danger, even within marriage, is that we can reduce this just to a physical activity. And that we don't... you missed so much awkwardness already in our conversation. But we're not done yet. So good. Well, so when we think about interacting with persons... again, when people do have struggles in their sexual life, a lot of it is because they're struggling to connect really on a deep personal level, right? That matters. I think one of the keys to a good sex life is loving your partner, loving your spouse well as a person. That goes a long way toward sexual intimacy, so that it's not just, I think the danger in our culture and even in some Christian books, is that we reduce good sex to kind of physical technique. And it's more than that. It's also important to acknowledge differences and assumptions. To realize that people come to marriage, people come to sexuality from different backgrounds. That people are shaped, right? If you've been taught that sex is something bad or something dirty, that's going to be something that's there and maybe a struggle, even if, yeah, you would say, well, mentally, I don't think that. But if you've been kind of trained, if you've been taught that, that can be difficult. We also have to recognize that different people are wired different ways, including men and women. This is the way that one book puts it. Now, this is a broad generalization, okay? But sometimes broad generalizations help. One book puts it this way: men okay, does that make sense? Do I need to elaborate further? Okay, now this is a I say this is a generalization, because I think oftentimes sometimes people talk about women as though women have no sexual desire or sex drive or anything like that, and I think that's dangerous. Or that we talk about men as being purely physical, as though that's all a man wants out of a relationship. But I think we do acknowledge that there are differences here, even in how we're wired. This is why if you read the How Our Bodies Work, right, everybody, PDF, it's there. There's a little bit about this, just in terms of thinking about differences in neurochemistry and how this works. Like for men to be sexually excited, what's the analogy? I forget. The analogy, I think it's something like this, if I don't get this wrong. That men are more like sports cars, right? 0 to 60 in like 4 seconds. Right, so it doesn't take much time. For men to get sexually excited, women are more like a big rig. Takes a while to get going. When they do, it takes a while to stop. Right? It's like you're going. Is this the day everybody's been waiting for in this class, or what?
My parents used the analogy of men are gas stoves that you just turn them on and turn them off, whereas women are electric stoves that take a while to heat up.
Oh, interesting. Interesting.
Crockpot from microwave.
Any other analogy? Let's make a list while we're thinking about it. I'll put it on my blog. Everybody, my class came up with 472 analogies. So I think we do need to acknowledge these differences, and Wes talks about this even in terms of a husband's attentiveness to his wife and what it means to love her well. Recognize that she is wired differently than he is. I was going to show this in class, but then I don't think we have time. One thing that I think about, and people in my church have mentioned this to me when I've talked about this in a marriage retreat, the Flight of the Conchords, Does anybody know where I'm going with this? Business time? Okay. It's okay if you don't know what I'm talking about. But if you do, this is a great example of a man being completely inattentive. Unattentive to his wife. Okay, maybe I'll have to show this in class at some point just to make sure we're all on the same page. So it's a great bad example. And so it's no wonder that if a husband is fairly inattentive to how his wife is wired, this sets us up for problems. Because if my wife is not feeling loved, guess what? She's really not feeling like this. And so there's a give and take too for women, which again I can only speak of from what I understand. This means that for my wife, she understands that I as a man am wired differently as well. And that's okay, that both of these are okay, but that we need to be aware of that and then learn what it means to acknowledge those and live with those. And this is where I think part of being self-giving means that I'm less concerned with how I'm wired than how my spouse is wired. And I'm seeking to live into that, not saying, well, you're really failing on this front. Again, I think this fits pretty closely with the second point, but when we think about sexual union, it is mental, spiritual, and physical. So that all of these dimensions are tied together, and that if we are out of sync on some of these levels, obviously I think we're going to be out of sync physically as well, but I think this also works the other way. This is why I think it's good and important to have a good, healthy sex life as a married couple, because this can actually help these things, right? So it's not just that, well, if everything is okay, then we'll have sex. Sometimes you should have sex to help set these things right, to remind you, right? It's like these renewal vows, like Wes talked about, that it is not just this physical act, but as you're engaged in this bodily union, you realize that you are this union of two persons. And so that's important. Passion and intentionality. This is one of the things, again, where I think even knowing science and biology can help us here, because we realize, and most people realize, that people have different levels of physical passion. This factors into our discussion. But there's also a sense in which I think the stereotype is that passion, you kind of lose passion the further along you go in your marriage. Right? This is why people, I remember, this is what I hated, like the first year of our marriage. Everybody like, oh, well, you're newlyweds, we'll enjoy it while it lasts. Right? And I'm like, okay, well, sorry, your marriage sucks. this kind of thing, where it's like, yes, there are differences and you grow, but at the same time, I think it does mean that the further on that you go into a marriage, you do have to, in some ways, perhaps be more intentional about it. But in other ways, it becomes easier because, guess what? Back to our people in the 40s and 50s, they know what they're doing. They've been doing this for a while, and it is something where they know each other well. It's a little bit like, can I use sports analogies? Okay. So I was thinking about this in preparation for the intramurals, okay? Which I'm very disappointed to find out we have referees. It's not call your own. That just, to me, call your own is like big boy basketball. I know when I foul you, right? Not that I just push people around, but I know when I foul you and I say it. I think the existence of referees really, there's a lot more lying in the world because of referees all around. But when you think about, being on a sports team with somebody, I play basketball, two or three times a week in the morning with the guys who play at 7 o'clock down in the gym. I've been playing with them probably a couple years. And so we all, right, it's not the same team, so we've all played with each other, offense, defense. I know how they play. They know how I play. They know what I'm good at. I know what they're good at. We kind of, everybody's like, what is going on with this analogy? Okay. So, right, this is the point. You're familiar with somebody if you've played on the same sports team with them for a long time. This is different. Now on Friday, I'm going to be forced to play with Dr. Cruzy and Fisher. Not forced to. I get to. But the point is, I don't usually play with those guys.
So they don't know what I'm good at. I don't know what they're, you know, so we're probably going to be fumbling around, making some mistakes. Not so good, right? Because you're not familiar with them. And this is part of the point. When you've played on the same team for 5, 10, 20, 30, 40 years, guess what? I don't want to say what I was thinking in my head, just didn't sound wrong. But you get really good at playing with each other, is what I was going to say. I think it's important that we acknowledge these things. This is how God made us to be, right? There's a reason that God's plan for human life is monogamy. All right, last thing, and then we'll keep moving. Different kinds of lovemaking. This actually, Tim Keller and his wife, in one of the marriage seminars they do, she talks about this. I can't remember her name. What is?
Kathy.
Okay, Kathy. I was going to say Helen, but I knew that was wrong.
That was the only thing that came to mind.
But she actually talks about, this is the analogy she uses, is the analogy of eating. And so she says there are gourmet meals, like Thanksgiving. There's your standard meat and potatoes, right? And then there's fast food. All right? Tim Keller's wife said this, not me. So part of what the point that she makes in this talk is just to acknowledge, it's okay to acknowledge that there are different kinds of lovemaking and to recognize there are different times when that's okay. You don't eat the same thing for every meal. Right, you don't. If somebody had to make Thanksgiving dinner for every night of the week, delicious, right, but exhausting. Right, it's that would just be too much. And so, just being able to be aware of this and talk about it, I think is important, so that spouses go into their marriage with clear understanding that, you know, it's not always the same. You read like Song of Songs. That's much more of a gourmet meal, all right? It's and so acknowledging this is important. A quote that's I think helpfully sums up how we should think about sex within marriage. Janelle Williams Parris says, "If marriage or marital sex is asked to deliver self-actualization or good sex on tap, it is likely to disappoint, but it can excel at what it is designed for, drawing people more and more deeply toward love. Practicing sex over and over in the course of a marriage makes plain that sexual intimacy is not an opportunity to get, have, or do a person or an experience. Instead, it's the opportunity to give and receive love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. The fruit of the spirit ripens in the body." And so some people may say something like, well, how can you really know a person if you haven't had sex with them, right? This is an argument some people may, you know, I'm not going to get married unless I've, you know, because how can I really know them until I have sex with them? Part of the question I think that Christians would ask is, you know, having sex with a person once means you know them? Like the Christian understanding of this is, in order to really know and truly love a person, you have to have sex with them over the course of a lifetime in the context of this complete commitment to them. That's when you're really going to know a person. That's when you're really going to understand who they are and really get to understand what love is about, what the fruit of the Spirit looks like. Do I dare ask any questions before we move on? No questions?
Okay, I've got one.
Okay.
Talking about how men and women are wired, do you think... I mean, obviously God has intentionality with the way he wires us.
Yeah.
But do you think that those wirings have been distorted over the course of you know, over the course of time, or is that how it's always been? We've just been different, and that's okay. Or
yeah,
obviously it's okay, but
yeah. Well, I think I would want to say that even the angle I would take on that is that even in creation, God clearly thinks diversity is good,
mm-hmm.
And so I think that there is a sense in which, again, this is not to say men and women are absolutely different,
mm-hmm.
but there's, I think, can be different points of emphases. And so I think that diversity is good, but I think certainly both of these things get taken up in human sin, that our desire, our connection for these things can warp the kind of emphasis that we place on this, or that we use these, that we can use these almost as weapons against our spouse.
I guess the way I see it is, like, you know, dealing with students, I mean, I see it as my own life too, but, like, for guys, we just want, you know, obviously we want the sex, and so we objectify it in a certain way,
yeah.
and idolize a certain, you know, or the emphasis that we have. But then girls, it's like, oh, it's the love, it's the connection, it's the, we want to emphasize that, and idolatry, or, you know, idolatry to that.
Yeah.
And so, you know.
Yeah, and so I think there are different temptations, again, to recognize, you know, pornography isn't something that only men have problems with, but it is, in general, something that I see more in men. Whereas in women, you know, people have used terms like emotional pornography or something like that to talk about, you know, romance novels, movies, etc., that depict men in a completely unrealistic way, right? In the same way that pornography does visually of women, and that both of those are damaging and distorting when we think about, you know, our actual spouse, who is there in front of us. So I think that, so maybe part of that is recognizing then, in, you know, where your weakness may lie more than anything.
All right.
Phew.
Now, celibacy.
Ooh, something refreshing.
All right. What I appreciate about this quote from Mother Teresa, the fruit of faith is love, the fruit of love is service. What I appreciate about this quote, and what I appreciate about West's chapter, is it really is an attempt to think very carefully about a theology of celibacy. And so if we think about celibacy, three questions. I'm actually interested in hearing your feedback here. How would you describe the attitude of our culture towards singleness, which is different from celibacy, by the way, right? There are many single people in our culture who are not, in fact, celibate. How does our culture think about celibate singleness? And how would you describe the attitude of churches toward singleness? Who wants to chime in any of these three? Let's talk about these for a few minutes. Yeah, Silas.
I just think, as a single man in the church, the church has a really largely unhealthy view of singleness, where we feel like we constantly have to be setting people up, and how people are incomplete until they're married, and we've elevated marriage to such a high level that, I mean, you look at our ministries and the churches, and any ministry geared toward singles is geared toward coupling them up, and after you're 30, the church doesn't know what to do with you.
Yeah.
They stop ministering. They're like, they didn't get coupled in our singles ministry.
Yeah.
Now they're 30, and you don't know. You know.
Good luck fending for yourself now.
Yeah, and then there's nothing.
We tried to set you up.
There's like a deficit of resources for people who are seeking singleness.
Yeah.
It's kind of sad.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, good. Other thoughts? Becca? So you're doing
great. Well, I know, speaking towards the general culture and the attitude towards singleness, I have personally had a friend who has set me up with almost every single Christian guy she knows, whether nominally or Catholic or Protestant.
All right.
And in her head, I'm not happy unless I'm dating somebody.
Mm. Yeah. So we're just here to do you a favor. We're going to help you out here, right? Like, thanks, don't do me any favors. Yeah, Carmen.
On the other end of the spectrum, I do think that part of our culture looks at singleness as some sort of power. Like, yeah. Oh, I'm single, so I can do whatever I want. I'm free to have sex with whoever I want.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I think that's right. When you think about the first question, when you think just about singleness in general, it is. It's this position of, I'm not tied down. I'm not obligated to anybody. I'm free to do whatever I want. Right? In a culture that values freedom, right? That's, you know, that's the kind of culture that sees marriage as a ball and chain. Right? Now I'm in prison. Right? That's basically like, so it is, it's interesting to see almost how they're just complete opposites of each other in that way. Yeah, Nick, you were going to chime in.
I was going to say the same thing.
Okay. So. All right. So,
over here. When it comes to celibate of singleness, especially Korean culture, for some reason they always think singleness is a bad for men. Like, my mom, I used to talk about this issue with my mom because I was like thinking about saying, you know what, I wouldn't mind being single for, but you know, I'm not celibate, so things like that. And I told my mom about it, and my mom instantly brought the scripture saying, God said it is not good for men to be alone. And I'm like, so even Christians, I think most of them think that celibacy is somehow inferior than, you know, marriage, and they usually justify it by saying, you know, God say it's not good, you know, it's not good for men to be alone.
Yeah, yeah, that's a go-to verse for moms everywhere.
Like the difference between singleness and celibate singleness, whereas like singleness is viewed as the ultimate power, like it's okay to be single, it's good to be single because then you can do whatever you want. But then, like, and I remember about this last night too, that celibate singleness is viewed as if you see someone who's celibate and single, you view them as, oh, they're lonely. Mm-hmm. And like they aren't trying hard enough, or they're not putting themselves out there. And like I know a lot of people who are celibate and single just because like they haven't. It's not like they just haven't had that type of person that they want to spend the rest of their life with, and they're fine with that.
Yeah.
But to hear all these stories of like.
Yeah.
People call them lonely. And
yeah.
Unhappy.
Yeah. Yeah. Very much looked down on in that sense. Let's see. There are a couple others. Kaylee and Karma. And then back over here.
Going back to like the church's attitude towards singleness, I think it's really interesting because in different, like, I don't know, like Christian settings of like retreats or small groups or like whatever. There's a big, like, this is the end goal. And, like, people who don't know you, it's like, oh, well, you'll find someone sometime. Like, don't worry. I'm like, wasn't worrying, but thanks for the assurance. And just kind of, like, I don't know, like, in, like, there's, oh, you have a lot of, like, everybody kind of has baggage. And, like, a lot of the reason for, like, people saying, like, you should work through that of, like, oh, if you want to get married, like, you should work through that. Like, that shouldn't be, like, the main reason. Like, what if you want to have, like, a good, like, abundant life, you know, for you to glorify God? Like, that should be the main reason, not so that you can, like, be in a relationship. I feel like that's the motivation and, like, that's the end goal. Like, that's what everybody thinks, even though you can be, like, a flourishing person on your own, not necessarily in a marriage.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. The way that it becomes kind of the be-all and end-all for how people think about themselves or their growth or something like that. Yeah. It wasn't, there's I've seen it, it'll circulate on Facebook every now and then. I don't know if it's a blog post, it was an article somewhere entitled something like, I'm not waiting anymore, or something like this that kind of says, the point is not just to be in waiting for this future thing that may or may not be part of God's will for your life. The point is to seek flourishing. Are there a couple other hands? Carmen, are you going to chime back in? And Taylor, and Eddie, you know.
Back to the celibate singleness. I totally agree with what Tim said, that like it's looked at like why would they do that? And the only time that I think I've heard it where it's been like, oh, it should be done, is when it's been talked about in the LGBTQ community.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. And that's a good point that I think is going to factor into this discussion, factor into some of what I say later, is that I think this is a big problem with how Christians have approached marriage and singleness and celibacy. I think when we do say marriage is the be-all and end-all, and you can't be happy, you can't be fulfilled without being married. And by the way, there's a whole group of people who can't be married. Now you've just said these people are kind of consigned to a lesser happiness, right? They can't have the same kind of life and fulfillment and completion. And so this is where I think the Catholic tradition, even though with this book, West especially focuses much more on marriage than singleness, historically has focused much more on celibacy and singleness as in some ways being a better or higher vocation.
Do you know what I mean?
I think the world in general views singleness, again, as the ultimate freedom, but celibate singleness as being, like, almost unhealthy. Or celibacy in general just as being unhealthy. That unless you are having sex, unless you're expressing yourself in that way, you're repressing yourself and it's not good for you.
Hmm.
I think that's the larger view of the world.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I think that's right. So very, very different between those first two points. Eddie?
Oh, it's all been said.
Okay. So, so when I think about churches, I think about this brief clip. This is, I think, many people in our churches. Media unavailable. Come on. Come on. Come on. I even did what I was supposed to do upstairs. Okay. Anyway. Moving on. It's only like a 25-second clip. It's from my big fat Greek wedding. When they're
YouTube.
Like,
probably on YouTube.
I'm sure it is. I don't want to take the time to look it up. That's why I embedded it here. Anyway, the whole point is like, should we send her to Greece to get married while she's kind of old? Okay, whatever. And it's like, maybe she doesn't want to get married. And they're all three like, she don't want to get married. And they're like, she don't want to get married. All right? Like, it's like, how could that be? Like, this is completely unthinkable. And I think that captures the attitude of many people in our churches towards singleness. Again, this despite the fact that, when you think about Jesus or you think about somebody like Apostle Paul, these are central figures. When you think about how the broader world looks at it, this echoes some of the comments that have been made.
Oh.
Right? That this is the kind of person who is celibate. Or we use it as a slam. Alright, after you use celibacy, he seems attractive. Or that it's just reducible to no sex, or that it's very unhealthy, unnatural. Right? The idea that people taking vows of celibacy really are just repressing something that's natural, and it's kind of when not taken care of in the right way is gonna cause problems. Celibacy bumper sticker, I guess, if you want this bumper sticker for your car. I don't know why people feel the need to do this. Celibacy, the most unnatural perversion. Okay, this is where I think it is helpful to come back to these different lenses. So that if you have the romantic lens where the focus is very much on connecting with, finding this person to fall in love with, it is seen as you're deprived of this experience of romance. Head over heels, you miss this, sorry. That's why people would kind of look down on you and say, wow, you're really missing out on this key component of life. When you take the plain sex lens, this is where I think this is reflected on the previous slide a little bit, to say, look, this is it's a physical, biological, bodily function. In some ways it'd be like saying, well, I'm never going to eat again. Well, you have to do that. That's just part of the biological function. And so to say I'm not going to engage in sexual intercourse, at least not while I'm single, is seen as a very, very odd thing, I think for a lot of people. This goes back to our sad-looking friend a couple slides ago. Again, as we've mentioned, to be single in some sense and unmarried, but engaging in sex, this is seen as, I can use this power to draw people in,
And so if I'm celibate, though, and I'm not doing that, it's almost this kind of sense of complete powerlessness. Like, this guy, no power. Right? What's the draw? There's nothing. There's no. Right? No, he just doesn't care.
He's, that's what he's actually. He's actually married. He's strong as
an old. He probably is.
He has 12 kids.
I got to make up some narrative in the background. He's like, you have no idea. So with the power lens, again, this is something where it can look very, very powerless. And through the expressive lens, where this is considered almost something that's psychologically healthy for you to pursue your personhood, your creativity, inside or outside of marriage, this now, you know, looks very much like something that's going to be unhealthy, that's going to be perhaps limiting who you are as a person. And so I think for all of these, there's a sense in which it is seen in a very negative light. Now, I do think it's very interesting when I think about the third bullet point here in terms of power. When you go back and look at New Testament times, your sexual life is very much determined by your social position in culture. That kind of dictates what you're going to do. And oftentimes, it would mean that you end up marrying somebody who you, right, it's a good social match or something like that. It's also something that for a lot of women was not seen as a very good thing or a very empowering thing, because they're largely having, you know, to marry somebody against their will or something of that nature. Whereas in the first and second centuries of the church, celibacy is really seen as this amazing expression of freedom and of power, to say that my destiny is not just determined by my social location. My destiny is not even just determined by my husband, but there's a sense that there's something else beyond just this social setup that is that I can connect with, and that gives me meaning and that defines who I am apart from marriage or sexuality. Now, I think especially from the two more Christian perspectives, the procreative lens. Obviously, if you are single and celibate, you are not procreating, okay? But this is where it's important to remember that even from a Catholic perspective, you're not somehow sinning because you're not getting married, right? That is no sin. And so, yes, you're not participating in this procreative act, but that does not lessen your ability to impact the kingdom. In fact, you know, this is where you go back to the quote from Mother Teresa. Even those who are single and celibate are expected to bear great fruit for the sake of the kingdom. So it's not a lack of fruitfulness, but it's a different kind of fruitfulness that is going on there. From the covenantal perspective, this is where I do think it's interesting to reflect on how individualistic our culture is, and to ask what it would mean for the church to really be a covenantal community of friends, okay? Because I think in our modern world, part of the reason that people are drawn to marriage is because we live in a transient society. People aren't necessarily connected to their families, to their place, or anything else. And so what are we connected to? Well, we're connected with this one other person that I've made vows to. And so marriage becomes this kind of the only relationship that we really can absolutely count on. And so this is where I think we as the church need to work against that, to say friendship within the context of the church community is a covenantal community, that we are committed to each other, and that this goes deeper, that you know, these covenantal bonds are not simply for the sake of marriage, but that we do covenant together as a community to live our lives together, to be committed to each other, and that Wesley Hill, who's written about this extensively, he's a gay celibate Christian, has even talked about, you know, vows of friendship, as you would have vows of marriage, that where people commit to each other in the same way that different religious orders have these kinds of vows in the Catholic tradition, where they take these vows, they enter these orders, and they are committed to each other. They don't just leave or move away.
I think I might be going off topic here, but I'll try to explain it. So one of the things that I see about American culture and Korean culture as well right now is that when people are in relationship, not marriage relationship, when they are in relationship as a significant other, boyfriend and girlfriend, they tend to think that in some way they belong to each other when they are actually not belong to each other. Because from what I understand about the Bible is that the Bible doesn't give any ground or any explanation about boyfriend-girlfriend relationship. It's either you're single or either you're married. So in my perspective, the best way for us to understand, as a Christian, to understand, you know, significant relationship is, even though you are in relationship with someone as a boyfriend and girlfriend, you should not really think to yourself as a somewhat, you know, married couple, but you should still consider yourself as a single. Then my question will be, how are we supposed to, you know, engage each other as a single person while you're not really a single anymore? Do you know what I'm saying? Like, it's just, we are just in a, that complex ground, and how are we supposed to, you know, engage in it? Like, are we supposed to be friends, just like you say, in a covenantal lens, or are we supposed to be just born and out?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good question.
What? Just get married.
Yeah. Well, I think it's right, and this is an area that is tricky to navigate because it doesn't, as you said, the Bible doesn't say here are the exact parameters for what should lead up to marriage. The Bible was written in written in the context of cultures where there are different practices regarding marriage. It's not just you as an individual make a decision about who you're attracted to. Or who you're committed to, and then make that decision. It's awfully a family decision, maybe even beyond your control. And so Scripture doesn't, I think, specify one form of these as being necessarily or inherently better. I think there is a sense in which what I would say is this means that if we're Christians, that there's this covenantal bond as Christians that first underlies anything. Even prior to or before marriage, even while dating or engaged, that there is a sense that I am responsible for this person as my brother or sister in Christ, first and foremost, and that I would seek their good because of that. That doesn't mean people never get hurt or there's not miscommunication or things of that nature. But I do think that relationship has to be even more primary than any kind of romantic or even marriage relationship. Any questions? All right, so when we think about these lenses, a couple of dangerous messages. This is from a really good book called Singled Out, Why Celibacy Must Be Reinvented in Today's Church. This is a very good resource in thinking about these things. And I just wanted to say these because I think part of what these do is illustrate the way that even Christian lenses get distorted by some of the other lenses. And so, you know, four things that they say. We've kind of already covered this, but great marital sex is the reward for being chaste, right? If you're chaste until marriage, then it's going to be awesome, right, no matter what. And I say, you know, we have to be careful there because even in terms of preparing ourselves for marriage, it's not this simple kind of cause and effect. That there's this kind of reward that happens because I did this. The other point that they make, which I think is important to remember, because I think West probably leans the other way, sex is sacred and necessary for spiritual maturity. That we recognize how important sex is, but that we don't, in some sense, make more out of it than it is. And I think this was a concern a few people raised last time in terms of saying, you know, if we're to say marriage is a sacrament, does this mean some people just miss out on this opportunity to grow or to be drawn deeper in their faith? And so we have to be careful here to talk about how important sex really is, but not to make it something that is kind of seen as absolute or absolutely necessary. Third, you have the right to be happy, and I heard several people allude to this in the comments. You must be married in order to be happy. Right? That is bad advice. Because for starters, you're marrying another sinner, right? And so the first thing you're going to find out is how miserable it is to actually live with another sinner at this level. So this, sorry, I feel like I've got, do I, I have one married couple, both the other. Can I get a witness from other married people? Right. You realize you're a sinner and they're a sinner, and you probably didn't realize just how bad a sinner you were until you did this. And so I think this is part of why, you know, if we go into marriage thinking, you know, this is like The Bachelor or something, right? It's not. You're gonna be miserable in that sense. And so, you know, that even we recognize marriages are for the purpose of making us holy, not just to make us happy. And guess what? God makes some people holy in and through marriage. God makes other people holy apart from marriage. And so this isn't essential to human happiness or to spiritual growth. Or we assume that marriage is God's primary institution on earth. And this is where I would say the church actually is God's primary institution on earth. That even when we think about the family is meant to point us to the reality of the church family. It doesn't diminish the importance of family or marriage. But we recognize that this is exactly why Jesus says you can leave those biological family connections behind in some sense. You're going to have sisters, brothers, fathers, mothers, a hundredfold, even in the present age. And so, yeah, this would be my response to Sub's mother. So you can tell this. This is what my professor says to you, Mom. So even think about this, you know, the statement when God says it's not good that man should be alone, he's talking about Eve. But I think in pointing forward, the way that Paul looks at Ephesians 5, who is the new Eve? Well, the new Eve is the church. And so when God says it's not good that we should be alone, his ultimate answer to that is the church, not our spouse. Because again, if we see our spouse as our solution to the problem of loneliness, that's actually putting on your spouse far more than they can bear, right? Husbands and wives aren't meant to be the be-all and end-all for their partner. And so that's, I think it's important that we get this straight. Look with me then at 1 Corinthians 7, because I want to briefly highlight a few points here when we talk about celibacy. I think 1 Corinthians 7 is often overlooked, but I think it's a very crucial text in thinking about singleness and thinking about marriage and what this all means. And in the context of 1 Corinthians 7, let me just read the first few verses. He says, wait, which group chose 1 Corinthians 7, 1? Okay. Now, for the matters you wrote about, and he's actually quoting them here, it is good for a man not to have sexual relations with a woman. This is what some people were teaching, that even for married couples in the Corinth church, it's wrong to engage in sex. But since sexual immorality is occurring, each man should have sexual relations with his own wife and each woman with her own husband. The husband should fulfill his marital duty to his wife, likewise the wife to her husband. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but yields it to her husband. In the same way, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but yields it to his wife. So part of what Paul does here, I think, initially is say, look, marriage is fine. Sexual intercourse is fine. This is not, so, you don't have to say, well, followers of Jesus are so spiritually pure that they never have to engage in this. He says that's actually setting yourself up for sexual immorality. Because especially if you're married, you are called to have sexual relations with your spouse. So he says clearly celibacy is not a standard for all, but he does say this is a call for some. In verse 7, he says, I wish that all of you were as I am, referring here in this context to his singleness. But each of you has your own gift from God. One has this gift, another has that. This is why some people refer to... I'll hear some people talk about celibacy as a gift. I have the gift of celibacy. Or they'll debate, does someone have the gift of celibacy? Or can you say to someone, you do have the gift of celibacy? And I don't want to make too much out of this language of gift here. I think it's important, but I think it might be dangerous to say, you know, this is how sinful human beings work. I haven't met the right person yet, but I certainly don't have the gift of celibacy. So that's why I need to kind of sleep around from time to time before I get married, because I don't have that gift. Well, that's not what 1 Corinthians 7:7 means. And I think we're abusing it when we act like it's just going to be easy to be celibate. And that's what it means when it talks about being a gift.
Yeah, and I think going off of that too, like, I think that, and I have friends who, like I said, are celibate and single because... like, that's not necessarily what they thought the plan would be for their life, but that's not necessarily what they wanted. But that's the path that God led them on. And so, like, when we think of celibate and single, we think of it as, like, oh, they're choosing that. Like, they're not trying hard enough. But really, yeah. like, it may not be their plan, but that's what God's plan is for them. So
yeah.
I think that's something.
Yeah, that is important to emphasize because I think, you know, it's one of those things where there are folks who are 40, 50, 60 who've never been married who would very much like to have been married or be married. And so usually somebody's like, well, how do I know if I have to get to celibacy? I mean, my question is, are you currently married? If the answer is no, then you have been called to celibacy. Right? Until the answer is yes. I mean, I think that's scripture's teaching. And so I think the difficulty with that is that this is where we're getting into the question, especially when we think about gay and lesbian Christians. Can you say to somebody, you've been called to a life of celibacy? And this is part of the debate around that is, you know, what do we make of that? What if somebody says, I certainly don't feel like I'm called to a life of celibacy. Like, I really want to be connected with another person. That's not easy, but I would make the point that's not something that just gay and lesbian Christians have to struggle with. So we need to say that as well. Jeremiah, the prophet Jeremiah, is called to singleness as a sign of the impending destruction. Right? This is part of his vocation as a prophet, is this call to singleness. Clearly, we see that in Jesus. We also see that in Paul. There's some discussion about whether Paul was married, and then his wife died. In any case, we do know that everything we know about him suggests that he's single. In part just because it would have been very atypical for somebody in his position as a Jewish man doing what he did as a Pharisee, as somebody who was well-versed in the law, to just be without a spouse. That would be somewhat odd. And so because of that, a lot of people think that he maybe was initially married, but that his wife died. But what you see in all three of these cases, I think, are clear examples of Christians called, or of God's people called to celibacy. And I think what you see in all of these is that part of what they do with that is minister and serve and function in a special way within the context of the people of God. I think it's also, again, it's just interesting when we think about how the Bible works, that Ephesians 5 says, Jesus, a single man, a celibate man, teaches us how to truly be good spouses. Right? So it's not as though celibate people kind of don't know what that means or how that functions. A couple other notes on 1 Corinthians 7. In verses 29 through 31, Paul says, this is in verse 29, from now on those who have wives should live as if they do not. Please do not misinterpret this text. I think it's interesting to see what he says here, though. His point is not to say, well, you know, forget it. I'm just acting like I'm not married. His point is that we're called to live in light of the new messianic era, that our marriages should be focused on service to God's kingdom, that the most important thing is not the marriage, that it's not the spouse or the children as ends in themselves, but even those who are married should live as if not in some sense, because they're oriented by something bigger, something that is beyond them. I think Paul's commands here also assume a community that supports one another in a variety of ways. And so part of the reason that he can say in verse 8, to the unmarried, to the widows, I say, it's good for them to stay unmarried as I do. Now again, especially for the women in Paul's context, if you are without a husband, that puts you in a very vulnerable position socially. Right? This is not the world that we live in. The first century world is largely a world where for many, not all, but for many women, their survival depends on being connected to their father's household or their husband's household. And so when Paul can say, you know, you don't have to go out and seek another husband. You don't have to seek a first husband or a first wife. This assumes that there is a community that's functioning like a family to support them. And these are just references. I mentioned these on the first day of class. The places where Jesus says, look, what I'm doing here is bringing into existence this new family. Because you're a new family, marriage becomes optional in a way that it never was before.
Right? I think this is a shift that you see happening because of the giving of the Holy Spirit, because of living in light of this new messianic era. Marriage becomes less significant than it had been. Now, Wes makes a couple of points I think are helpful then. If we take 1 Corinthians 7 into account, Wes underscores that both married people and celibate people participate in the spousal meaning of the body. So this is important to get. It's not just one or the other, but it's both of them together. Help us see this. When sexuality is devalued, both marriage and celibacy are devalued. So that there is a link there. It's interesting. I think that our culture, in a lot of ways, looks down on marriage. Doesn't necessarily see it as something necessary, something good to pursue. Sexuality, likewise, is seen as, you know, people are treated as objects to consume. So you see both of these, I think, struggling. But both of these mutually interpret each other. If you have your textbook, look at what he says on page 69. He says, he quotes John Paul II. He says, this is under the heading, marriage and celibacy complement each other. He says, marriage and celibacy obviously differ in important ways, yet these differences do not conflict. The values of one and the other vocation interpenetrate. In fact, marriage and celibacy explain or complete each other. Marriage reveals the spousal nature of the celibate vocation, just as the celibate vocation reveals the great value of marital union. Right? Did you get that? Marriage reveals the spousal nature of the celibate vocation, just as the celibate vocation reveals the great value of marital union. There's a sense in which single people look at married people. This is helpful in our culture. Remember what we said? How does our culture think about singleness? It's being free. I'm not tied down. I'm not obligated. Married people, or single people, should look at married folks and say, that's what my life should look like in service to God's kingdom. Being single, being celibate, doesn't mean I'm free to do whatever I want. No, it means I am free to serve, maybe even in more powerful ways than married folks could serve, because I have more time, more energy, right, to expend in ways that married people, like myself, I'm stuck changing a lot of diapers. That's good, but that also means there are other things I can't do. I don't have time for it. But the single person can look at me and say, man, he's got to go to work all day, then he's got to come home at night and help wrangle four sinful children every night, where just getting people to, like, eat their dinner is, no. Right? Basic bodily functions to keep you alive. Somehow children are like, I don't want to do that. Like, you idiot. That's what, if I ever write a book on parenting, I'm just going to call it Becoming Unstupid. That's my goal. Like, don't have to be brilliant, just become unstupid. A little bit at a time. But the single person can look at me and say, wow, he is kind of stuck doing a lot of stuff for his family. And hopefully that's a picture, though, of a single person's devotion and dedication to what God is calling them to do, how they're being called to minister to people and connect with people in their life. Likewise, a married person like myself can look at a single person and say, that person is focused on something greater than just the family. They have time and effort and energy to expend in service to God's kingdom. And so my life needs to mirror that, in the sense that my marriage, my family, is oriented to service beyond itself. The goal for my life is not just that my kids have really great experiences, right, and get to play all the sports and do all the things and, right, whatever. That's not the goal. And so that pushes us, I think, to recognize that we need each other, because without that, I think it's easy for married folks to make marriage and family an idol in and of itself, and it's easy for single people to just see themselves as free from obligation instead of free for service. Celibacy also serves, and Wes touches on this a little bit, serves as a sign of the new creation, that our ultimate fulfillment lies in God alone. And so this is what, hopefully, we all come to learn, whether married or single. But part of what the single person can say is, guess what? You don't complete me. Other individuals do not complete me. Ultimately, it is God who fulfills who I am and fills the deepest need of who I am. And this is where I do think, this is where, who was it, maybe Kaylee or Carmen mentioned earlier, the kind of like how we, it's like, well, do this so that you can get married, right? And this is why I sometimes hear people will say something like this in the context of, you know, you just have to, you know, get right in your relationship with God before he's going to let you meet somebody else or something like that. Now, that may be true, but again, you're kind of turning your relationship with God into this instrumental thing to help you catch somebody. Right? And that's not helpful. I think maybe what that is trying to get at is that if you recognize this, this is actually going to make you a much healthier single person and a much healthier spouse. Because spouses who don't get this but try to think their ultimate fulfillment comes through their husband or wife, that's a good recipe for ruin in terms of your marriage. And as Wes points out, then, the spousal meaning of the body is carried forward even by celibate Christians. That they are called to be a gift, to be self-giving, to give their lives in self-giving love for others, just as spouses give themselves to one another, and that there is a spiritual fruitfulness that grows from this. And so it's not as though the spousal meaning is ignored or erased, but in some sense, this is helping especially married people understand the true spousal meaning of the body. So that I would hope as a married person that my fruitfulness for the kingdom is not just that I have children, but that I am called to actually make disciples of my children. That's really the outcome, that's really the goal, is this kind of spiritual fruit, not just simply fruitfulness in a more physical or bodily sense. Now, when we think about celibacy as a sign of new creation, I think this is connected even to how we think about consummation. In other words, when we think about our resurrected, glorified state, one of the big questions is, you know, I think a big question is, will you be married to somebody? If you're married in this life, are you married in the resurrected life to come? This is a little bit, I think, we'll see what Jesus says about this, but this is what Wes says, that in the resurrection, the primordial sacrament, marriage, will give way to the divine reality. That marriage is this sign that points to something, but that at a certain point, it no longer becomes necessary. Now, this is interesting because I think, according to what different people are telling me, Christians often see singleness as this waiting time toward marriage, whereas the biblical narrative seems to flip this, that marriage is something that God institutes in the beginning, but that ultimately it gets transcended in the end. Which I think is kind of fascinating. And so Jesus, if you have your Bibles and look at Matthew 22, this is the really, I think, the one place in Scripture that addresses this kind of question. And so the Sadducees, maybe you're probably familiar with the story, the Sadducees come and ask this question. Teacher, they said, Moses told us that if a man dies without having children, his brother must marry the widow, raise up offspring for him. Then they tell the story where seven brothers die. That's kind of unfortunate. It's like seven brides for seven brothers, but without six of the brides. I don't know, strange. You ever go back and watch like old shows like that, and you're like, wow, this is very misogynistic and patriarchal. But that's some good dancing. Yeah. How did those guys dance wearing, anyway, what they're doing? And so Jesus replies to them. So they ask this question because they think, aha, Sadducees, by the way, again, don't believe in the resurrection. Look, marriage is going to show that this quandary with the law shows there's no such thing as a resurrection. Jesus flips it around and says, you're in error because you do not know the scriptures or the power of God. At the resurrection, people will neither marry nor be given in marriage. They will be like the angels in heaven. But about the resurrection of the dead, have you not read what God said to you? I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. He is not the God of the dead, but of the living. And when the crowds heard this, they were astonished at his teaching. Now, I think it is important to recognize that the main focus of this text, I think, is more about the reality of the resurrection rather than Jesus trying to give us insight into exactly what that's going to look like for married people in the life to come. And so different people have tried to, you know, what does this mean, neither marry nor be given in marriage? I actually had a professor who
argued that this meant there would be no Levirate marriage, right? That's what's being talked about here, where if somebody dies, then somebody else, the next brother in line, steps into place so that there could be a rightful heir. Kind of saying, well, that's what goes by the wayside. That's what is being meant by neither marry nor be given in marriage. That's interesting, but I don't know. It's one option. I think it's stretching it a little bit. Most people have simply taken this in a kind of straightforward way to say, there is no marriage. And consequently, as you would assume then, maybe you would not assume, I don't know, there is no sexual intercourse in the resurrection. And so this is, how do we think about this? I think about it, you know, even from the perspective of the two shall become one flesh. This is what I have a little bit of trouble wrapping my mind around, is that, you know, if I spend my life with my wife, even in the life to come, there's a sense in which I at least will enter that life knowing her better than anybody else. I don't think it means that we just erase what happens in this life, right? That I think what happens in this life does matter. But what that actually looks like, I think the scriptures don't give us too much indication. But I think, again, what West is pointing to here, and I think even what Jesus is pointing to, is that the covenantal relationship, the bond that we have in marriage, is meant to be this sign and pointer to the communion of the saints that we have in Christ, and the communion of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. And so, whatever it is, it's better. It draws us further into this communion with others, that there's a sense in which, because of time, place, and other limitations, I can't be drawn into connection and communion with everybody that I come into contact in this life, even people in my own church. Right? There's not that same level of connection because there's simply not that level of time, and there's different obstacles there. And so the idea is that this is pointing to something deeper. Here's how C.S. Lewis talks about it. This is an extended quote, but it's C.S. Lewis, so it's good. He says, "The letter and spirit of Scripture and of all Christianity forbid us to suppose that life in the new creation will be a sexual life. And this reduces our imagination to the withering alternatives, either of bodies which are hardly recognizable as human bodies at all." And so when people say, like, the angels, does this mean we'll be, like, androgynous or non-sexual? That seems a little strange. Or else of a perpetual fast. As regards the fast, I think our present outlook might be like that of a small boy, who, on being told that the sexual act was the highest bodily pleasure, should immediately ask whether you ate chocolates at the same time. Okay? On receiving the answer no, right, because this is like the highest thing he can conceive of as a small child. On receiving the answer no, he might regard absence of chocolates as the chief characteristic of sexuality. In vain would you tell him that the reason why lovers in their carnal raptures don't bother about chocolates is they have something much better to think of. The boy knows chocolate. He does not know the positive thing which excludes it. We're in the same position. We know the sexual life. We do not know, except in glimpses, the other thing which in heaven will leave no room for it. Hence, where fullness awaits us, we anticipate fasting. I think that's an interesting statement. Because that is very much, I think, you know, we're just working with what we know. And so when we hear it's not this, we think, wow, we're going to be missing out on something. Where fullness awaits us, we anticipate fasting. In denying that sexual life, as we now understand it, makes any part of the final beatitude, it is not, of course, necessary to suppose that the distinction of sexes will disappear. What is no longer needed for biological purposes may be expected to survive for splendor. Sexuality is the instrument both of virginity and of conjugal virtue. Neither men nor women will be asked to throw away the weapon they have used victoriously. It is the beaten and the fugitives who throw away their swords. The conquerors sheath theirs and retain them. And I think it's interesting because, again, he suggests here is not that we somehow lose the male-female differentiation, but that this is very much part of who we are. So when we think about even our resurrected state as bodily beings, it doesn't mean that we become, you know, immaterial. It doesn't mean we lose our bodies, and it doesn't mean we lose those characteristics that do, in fact, mark us as male and female.
And so this is I think, at least interesting. I think Lewis's analogy, I don't know about you, but Lewis's analogy with the chocolates, I think, does help us somewhat to say, you know, we have to realize we're working within our limited experience, and that we're looking ahead to something beyond. It's also important, side note, important though, that he does say men and women. There's actually some early, there's a few writings here and there where people speculate, well, when you read names of angels, they all seem like they're male names. And so in the resurrected state, we'll all be male. This was partly due to the fact that Aristotle, who's not a Christian, by the way, but the philosopher Aristotle essentially defined women as kind of deformed men. Right? He saw them as like, there's something wrong. Right? This is Aristotle, this is not me. But so, you know, some would read this and say, okay, this is, you know, you will be perfected in that state. This is not the case. And so, I wanted to just go to kind of wrap up some of the different things we've said. Four basic theses that I would put forth on celibacy and singleness. First, I think we need to focus on chastity versus lust. We talked about this a couple class periods ago. Not just the question of married or not. Because I think a lot of times when we focus on, you know, somebody married or not, you know, we kind of think, well, married, so you must be good. You must be okay. Not be struggling with sexual sin or have difficulty related to that. And that's not helpful. Actually, I want to, under this context, read this quote from Rosario Butterfield. She says, "What good Christians don't realize is that sexual sin is not recreational sex gone overboard. Sexual sin is predatory. It won't be healed by redeeming the context or the genders. Sexual sin must simply be killed. What's left of your sexuality after this annihilation is up to God. But healing to the sexual sinner is death. Nothing more, nothing less. I think too many young Christian fornicators plan that marriage will redeem their sin. Too many young Christian masturbators plan that marriage will redeem their patterns. Too many young Christian internet pornographers think that having legitimate sex will take away the desire to have illicit sex. They're wrong. And the marriages that result from this line of thinking are dangerous places. Marriage does not redeem sin. Only Jesus himself can do that." I think this is a very helpful perspective that we don't need to get caught up, I think, so much in the question of married or single versus how are we all called to chastity? And what does that look like? I also think we need to pioneer new forms of community. For about probably 10 plus years now, different people have tossed around this term new monasticism. When you think about the monks, these are groups of people who commit to each other, who commit to a way of life lived in community. Often though, historically, it's been only celibate Christians. But part of the question is now, how do, in a world that is very transient, how do we form stable communities as a body of believers who are committed to each other, single and married? That married people, people with families, right, would open their homes and be connected with other single Christians. And how do we think about, again, in a world where the age of marriage is getting pushed back further and further, how do we think about new forms of community where you do have single Christians, both male and female, living in community? And what does that look like? But I think this is something we need to think more deeply about, because I think this is one of the things we have to offer to the world around us. I think we need to talk more about the shared vocation of all Christians, that this is what orients us, our call to kingdom living, and that we ask how our marriages and families connect with that. We also ask how our goals for life as single Christians fit into that. Because often, now I don't know if this is true or not, I know that if I'm going to make a life decision, my wife is going to question me on that. Joys of being married. Right? So how do you, if you're a single Christian, how do you in some sense submit yourself to the wisdom of other Christians as well to say, listen, my life needs to be first and foremost oriented by service to God's kingdom. How do I judge that? How do I discern that as I make important life decisions going forward? Then fourth and finally, we need to be countercultural even toward the Christian subculture. Right? My big fat Greek wedding is wrong. Many of our parents and churches are wrong. And so we need to be willing to speak a word of truth into that and to live a word of truth, live that out in our lives where we say, the end goal of this is not just to set people up. It's not just to find a spouse. If that does happen, that God does things that way, that's fine. But that's not the point. And I think Paul's message in 1 Corinthians 7 was profoundly countercultural in its time. And I think our message needs to be profoundly countercultural too. The world won't understand it, but especially the celibacy part. That they can't understand that. But I think even many Christians don't understand that. Why? Because tragically, many of our marriages, families, and single lives are not, in fact, oriented by God's kingdom. So that's an issue. We need to make that the center thing. All right, we'll stop there. For this time, next time we'll look at West chapter 8 and the Humanae Vitae handout. Again, if you weren't here earlier, don't forget the quiz for that is on Sakai. Just do that before class next time.